Recovery of walking after complete spinal cord injury.
Repairing the mitral valve in patients with heart failure without surgery.
Can you trust the medical information you get from Siri or other digital assistants?
And does antibiotic treatment for appendicitis really work?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be hosted on September 28, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should start with this pretty remarkable paper in the New England Journal of Medicine. It only talks about 4 people, but what they attempted to do in these folks was to help them to recover their ability to walk after they had complete spinal cord injury. This is really remarkable. You and I were both completely jaw-droppingly amazed at the video that's available of these people ambulating with assistance after all of this intensive therapy. These were, as I said, only 4 patients. They did intensive training. They were 2.5 to 3.3 years post their traumatic spinal injury. And they also used epidural stimulation, a device over their spinal cord, in order to help them to do this. 2 of these patients with the epidural stimulation are actually able to ambulate, to walk with assistance, but even so, to walk. And the other 2 also had some recovery of function with independent standing and trunk stability, so they didn't have to be supported in a wheelchair. Pretty amazing stuff, and something that's been a holy grail for a while.
So, Elizabeth, this actually took place in 2 parts. So first, they did what's called locomotor training. They put them in weight-supported devices and tried to attempt to teach them to walk, and they were unsuccessful. And then they applied the spinal stimulation. And by the way, they synchronized it with the motor movement by checking the electroactivity in the lower extremities. And then they continued the locomotor training. So that combination of the training with the spinal stimulation allowed these individuals to walk. Now, the thing that you didn't mention is when they turned off the spinal stimulation, they were no longer able to ambulate. And secondly is it wasn't the spinal stimulation that did it. It was the combination of the spinal stimulation and their intention as well. It took both of those events to make it happen.
Right. They had to have a higher level cognitive intention. I am going to do this in order to start to generate some of those signals. All of this, of course, pretty powerful stuff. The intensity of it, the fact that this spinal cord stimulation is needed, sounds like there's still some work to do.
There is, Elizabeth. And as you mentioned, individuals were trained for between 15 to 85 weeks. And by the way, there's another report in Nature Medicine this week of another individual that responded to this therapy. So it's very early on, but it's extremely encouraging.
Very. I was a little startled by the statistic that 1.3 million people in the United States alone are estimated to have paralysis relative to spinal cord injury. So huge public health problem.
And we know that early treatment usually gets better. And so the other question is, if we apply this earlier, is there a different type of stimulation, different type of training? But for proof of concept, this is pretty amazing.
And the one that I'll feature on the blog. Let's turn to a study that you're going to talk about. This is using, also in the New England Journal of Medicine, a clip on the mitral valve for people with congestive heart failure.
Now, this clip was actually approved in 2013, and it was meant to allow a procedure to be done in individuals that needed to have the mitral valve, that is a valve between the upper and lower chambers on the left side of the heart. When it was leaky, usually that's fixed with surgery. But in people that were extremely high risk, is that if we could do a procedure that actually clipped the leaflets together, much as if you took a paper clip and clipped things together, we could prevent some of that leakiness. Now, we have a group of individuals in whom the mitral valve isn't the primary issue, but they have heart failure. And as their heart gets bigger, the 2 leaflets don't touch one another. They don't close properly. And it can make the situation worse. So in this particular study, they took people that had symptomatic heart failure. Their heart was enlarged. They had a leaky valve. They were considered to be at high risk for surgery. And half of them got randomized to just medical therapy. The other half to medical therapy plus some mitral clip. Over 600 patients, and those that had the mitral clip, it reduced their risk of being hospitalized for heart failure over the next 2 years by about 50%, and it lowered their risk of death about 40%. That means the death rate was 29% in people that had mitral clip and 46% in those that had just medical therapies. This is a high-risk group.
I have two questions about this. I need you to help me to understand the mechanics of actually clipping the mitral valve. Then, gosh, wait a second, we still have to allow blood flow.
And that's a great question, Elizabeth. So what happens? It doesn't clip it completely shut, reduces the amount of leakiness. So it's not as good as surgery in preventing leakiness, but it's a lot less risky to perform. And in fact, when you ask about what were the complications related to the device over the course of 2 years, only about 4% of individuals had a device-related complication.
And my other question is, how often do mitral valve leakiness and congestive heart failure coexist?
Well, it's increasingly more of an issue because in the past, people had a high mortality when they had, for example, a heart attack. Now they survive their heart attack, but over the course of the ensuing months and years, their heart begins to enlarge and they develop heart failure. So this affects millions of individuals. And this was done at a very experienced centers, by the way. So the outcome in part is so good because these are centers that have been doing this for years.
So I guess that's one caveat we would offer. Okay, now let's turn to sort of the other end of the spectrum, a journal we have never talked about before, the Journal of Medical Internet Research. And this is an admittedly small study, but kudos to these folks for even thinking about this. They took a look at what they call conversational assistants, Siri, Alexa, and Google Assistant, to ask the question, hey, how good are these devices at providing trustworthy medical information? And I've been in situations where I've heard people actually query these devices for this kind of thing, so I thought this was really interesting. They only had 54 subjects in this study with a mean age of 42 years. They asked their digital assistants for information relative to medical questions that they tended to act on. And of these, 49 of those, or 29%, reported actions that could have resulted in some degree of patient harm, including 27 or 16% that could have resulted in death. And I thought this was pretty daunting with regard to the veracity of these assistants.
What I found astounding, Elizabeth, was you said this was a study of only 54 subjects, so it's fairly limited. But when you look at the number of people that use these devices, that use Siri or Alexa or Google, they're over 500 million worldwide. And you're right, we ask it about the weather, we ask about where the latest movie is, and now people ask about medical advice. And I found it remarkable, as you did, that it did not give very good advice in a significant number of times it was used. I think the results are really fairly far-reaching.
I think we really need to somehow get our arms around this problem, or at least make people aware of the fact that this is not good advice and that they really ought not to be querying their digital assistant for medical information.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, when you ask it advice, you give it limited information. For example, you say, I have a headache and what should I take? Well, it doesn't know what your past medical history is or what other medications you're on or whether you have any allergic reactions. So it can't possibly give good medical advice with a limited amount of information. So our message to our listeners is, don't be using Siri, Alexa, or Google. It's not the same as a healthcare provider.
Okay. And finally, let's turn to your last one. This is a look at long-term outcomes relative to the use of antibiotics to treat acute appendicitis. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
We reported on this study initially years ago. The study was conducted about 5 years ago, where they took individuals that had uncomplicated appendicitis and randomized them to either have surgery, because that was the routine therapy, or just antibiotic therapy. And by the way, if the person wasn't doing the well, the surgeon could take the patient to surgery after antibiotic treatment. The people with surgery overall did well, although there were some complications associated with it. But the people that received antibiotics also did fairly well. About a fourth of them went on to need surgery, but they didn't have a complicated surgery. They just did pretty well, and three-fourths of them avoided surgery. But what the follow-up study does is it extends the observation over to 5 years. There were 530 patients in the study randomized to either go appendectomy or to receive antibiotic therapy. And what they looked at in those individuals that had antibiotic therapy, as we mentioned, about 25% of them went on to have surgery in the first year. But over 5 years, that number was just 40%. That is just an additional 15% of individuals went on to have surgery. Of those 100 individuals that had surgery, 7 of them didn't even have appendicitis. So the surgery was done when it really wasn't necessary. So this shows that the 5-year follow-up of antibiotic therapy for uncomplicated appendicitis really doesn't put the individual at harm.
And I think it's a really good news study because, as you know, I'm not a fan of surgery, particularly when it's not indicated.
Yeah. One of the things that makes this treatment available now is, in the past, it was difficult to make the diagnosis of appendicitis. All these individual studies had a CT scan initially that showed that they either had appendicitis or not, and whether it was complicated or uncomplicated. And we're talking about the uncomplicated patients who responded well to antibiotic therapy.
On that good news note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.